take a second to listen to Jennifer. She lives in Brooklyn, New York. She's a mom of two, a three-year-old and a nine-year-old named Corday, who's in the fourth grade.
We would stand up on the corner by the little Link NYC free Wi-Fi post that they have on like every other corner. And we'll stand there and he'll be able to do his work.
Jennifer talked with us on a staticky cell phone line. She doesn't always have stable Wi-Fi because for the past 3.5 months, Jennifer and her kids have been living in a family homeless shelter. And that lack of stable Wi-Fi means sometimes Jennifer and Corday have had to take his device outside to connect to his fourth grade remote classes using the city's free Wi-Fi. So they would stand on the sidewalk trying to do school.
There'll be times where I'll email his teacher, like, we can't stand outside today, it's raining, or, you know. And she would be understanding of it. But pretty much it'll be right on the corner, on the top of the hill from where we live, standing so that he can get his work done. It's been a hassle, but I tried to give him very little excuses as far as, you know, his schooling.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. And imagine what that's like, having to do school outside on the street corner, just trying to catch some stable Wi-Fi, because your family's life has already been shaken by the instability of homelessness. More than 1.5 million U.S. public school students experienced homelessness in 2018, the highest number in a decade. They live in cities and in rural America. And for them, school is one of the most important sources of safety, security, and support in their lives. So when school doors close, what happens to these kids? Fourth grader Corday is among the approximately 2,000 New York City children who go to bed in one of 12 shelters run by WIN, a nonprofit group that's the city's largest provider of shelter for homeless families. Christine Quinn is WIN CEO.
Well, you know, that whole time in March was dark, right?
New York is home to the largest public school system in the country. And in March, during the pandemic's first wave, the city closed school buildings, which meant that WIN had to transform its shelters into schoolhouses.
We had to figure out how to keep our staff safe, between 500 and 600 people, how to keep our clients safe, 5,000 people, and how to make sure everyone got the education they needed, got the medicine they needed, etc.
The needs quickly grew. WIN clients needed help navigating online schooling, so the shelter raised money to create a better hotline for families to call.
That is outrageous.
Quinn believes the technical gaps reveal a bigger problem, a devastating blind spot the city has regarding the families she serves.
The core of the disgrace is the fact that the city is pretending that if they believe there are no homeless children, there will be no homeless children. And living in that kind of a denial is outrageous and profoundly dangerous.
We reached out to the New York City Department of Education for comment. They did not respond. But in September, the New York Times reported about technology issues for students living in WIN shelters. A spokesperson told the Times that the department was, quote, wholly committed to helping their most vulnerable students succeed. New York City schools did reopen this fall. Hundreds of thousands of students went back to in-person learning. Then, after less than 8 weeks, the city's coronavirus test positivity rate hit 3%. So on November 18th, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that city schools were closing again. Today is a tough day, de Blasio said, but quote, this is a temporary situation.
And I want to emphasize to parents, to educators, to staff, to kids, that we intend to come back and come back as quickly as possible.
Of course, the pendulum swinging back and forth like this means even more instability for homeless students. De Blasio insisted the city is doing better for these children.
We had a lot of concerns about our kids in shelter. We have had technicians going out to the shelters, working family by family to make sure their service is working.
On Sunday, de Blasio suddenly announced that he's reopening the city's public elementary schools, an abrupt about-face following intense criticism that the city was focusing more on restaurants and gyms than on children. Elementary schools are now set to reopen on December 7th. However, only those kids who had already signed up for in-person learning can return, meaning only a third of New York's 1 million school children are even eligible. Christine Quinn is not impressed. Many kids will still be learning remotely. And every night, she sees almost 2,000 students fall asleep in the wind shelters. And in the morning, once again, those shelters become schools.
So they do most of their work in their units, like where everyone lives. They have a little dining room table there, et cetera, or maybe they work on their bed. We have staff assigned to a new position, which is basically they roam the halls. And they'll knock on a door and say, hi, how's everything going? Do you need any help with your schoolwork? You know, or maybe a child will be out in the hallway and they'll look frustrated and staff will sit down with them in the hallway or try to get them back into their room to work through whatever they're working through. And we also do, like, every night we put like a good luck package on their door that has some notes about the next day's exam, some shout outs to kids who did really well, maybe, you know, an unhealthy chocolate treat, a little toy. So just to make it a little less horrible. Most shelters' capacities have not really changed a lot because no one's really left. You know what I mean? They don't really go. Now, the work we're doing is more robust. We now have extra people doing homework help all day long, roaming the hallways, being there to do that. We had to set up a temporary school, socially distant school, if you will, for the children of essential workers. With this administration and ones before it, they forgot about the homeless kids. It was like, oops, oh yeah, and things are different for them. They just forgot about the homeless kids. And so then when they were reminded, they pledged the de Blasio administration that of the free devices he had, the 300,000, that they would go first to the homeless children and then to children in the housing authority. Big promise made, big promise broken. We did not receive our iPads until 2 weeks after school started and after a New York Times cover story airing our complaints. Every other child in a school could be a homeless child. You know what I mean? When you left last March, you may have been going home to a house that had a laptop, an iPad, and a stand-up computer. And it's no big deal. Of course you have all those things. And the child who walked out of the school right after yours was going not to a home but to a shelter where there was no Wi-Fi services and no devices that they owned or had the ability to own. And I think New Yorkers need to keep that in mind as this pandemic continues.
Christine Quinn is CEO of WIN, a nonprofit organization that is New York City's largest provider of shelter for families experiencing homelessness. Now, of course, it's not something that just New Yorkers need to keep in mind. The entire nation needs to keep children who are experiencing homelessness in mind now in the midst of this pandemic and what impact it's having on their education. So joining us now is Barbara Duffield. She is executive director of Schoolhouse Connection, a nonprofit that's focused on homeless youth and education. Barbara, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So first of all, can you just describe to us what is it that children lose, children who are experiencing homelessness, what is it that they lose when their school doors close?
When schools close, children and youth who are homeless lose the single greatest source of stability in their lives. They lose the place that they come to every day, where they have shelter over their head temporarily, food, caring adults, and the structure and normalcy that really is the respite from the rest of their lives, from homelessness.
So it sounds like they lose almost everything that is stable outside of the family that they outside of their family.
That's true. That's true. They lose access to basic needs and again a more or less normal environment. And of course, you know, with the challenges with distance learning, they may also lose out on the education that ultimately they'll need to get out of homelessness.
Now, we will talk about academics in a second, but given what you just said about the totality of what schools are providing to these children, I did want to just briefly ask you. I keep quoting this number of 1.5 million school children facing or experienced homelessness in 2018. We're in 2020 now. And I'm seeing some reporting that says the number might actually be less than that, but not for the best reasons.
Yes. So what we heard at the beginning of the 2021 school year, is that the people who were designated to identify students who are homeless were seeing fewer numbers. Their numbers were significantly reduced at a time when every indicator would point to increased family homelessness. We surveyed those individuals, McKinney-Vento liaisons designated under federal law, and we found about, on average, a 28% drop in the number of students experiencing homelessness identified by public schools, not because we've magically solved family homelessness during a pandemic, but because it's so hard to identify families and youth who are homeless when schools are closed.
So, Barbara, stand by for just a second, because we have to talk about more regarding the implications of what you just said, but we'll do that on the other side of the break. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about school children who are experiencing homelessness and what happens to those kids when their school doors close because of the pandemic. I'm joined today by Barbara Duffield. She's executive director of Schoolhouse Connection, a nonprofit that's focused on homeless youth and education. And Barbara, you had just said before the break that the number of children experiencing homelessness, that absolute number might have gone down, but not because there are actually fewer children experiencing homelessness, but because they are harder to find? And can you explain a little bit why is it that they're harder to track and identify right now?
Sure. When children and youth are coming to school every day, you have eyes and ears who are looking for signs of potential homelessness. Everyone from enrollment staff who may be asking about a student who's moving, teachers who notice children are falling asleep in class, cafeteria workers who notice that children are hoarding food, coaches who notice that children are showing up earlier or staying late after school. When schools are closed, all of those signs are not there anymore. And you may not even be rerouting buses when children move to where they're currently staying. So that's why we're very concerned that the drop in the number of identified students who are homeless doesn't reflect reality. It reflects the fact that these students may be disconnected from school and we don't know who they are or where they are.
And the drop is something like at least 400,000 children?
Yes. Based on our survey of school districts, a 28% drop in comparing this school year to last school year at the same time means 420,000 fewer students experiencing homelessness identified and getting the help that they need to succeed.
So, okay, so Barbara, hang on for just a second, because I have to just spend a minute thinking about the fact that these children essentially, the pandemic with the schools closing as a result of it, at a time that their families might have the greatest need, the pandemic has pushed them off the radar. So they can't even get the services that they were once eligible for when they could go into school buildings?
Correct. Everything from, again, access to food and health care and other supports, just basically even having a place to be during the day, gone. And educators really struggling to do the kind of outreach that would allow them to know where these children are and how to meet their needs.
Okay, one more question for you, Barbara. Well, I've got tons more, actually. But so I find myself sometimes in these conversations falling into a cognitive trap when we talk about supporting kids and services, et cetera. They're slightly sanitized words, I'll be perfectly honest. But you were saying things like educators, when they're able to be in buildings with children, notice things, they're looking for things like children hoarding food because they may not have enough, right? Do you have an example of the kinds of, this, like maybe just before the pandemic, before schools first closed in March, of like the kinds of fundamental help that these children are getting while they're able to be in school?
Yes, actually, I'm thinking specifically about one young man who was part of our youth leadership program. You know, the help that children and youth get at schools, yes, it's material, but it's also immaterial help that helps them survive. So, for example, thinking about the role of counselors and the mental health crises that these students experience. And one young man who a counselor had reached out to him over and over again, he was suicidal. Finally, he reached back and she was able to hold on and save his life, essentially. So I think about that as one very poignant example of the kinds of supports that are missing to these students who have so many layers of trauma, and now they've got some additional ones.
Okay. So Barbara, hang on for a second here, because I want to bring into the conversation Carrie Tobin. She's a professor at Louisiana State University School of Education. Her research focuses on the effects of poverty on children's education, and she's co-author of Homelessness Comes to School. Professor Tobin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we talked a lot about, we heard the stories from New York City at the beginning of the show, but I want to emphasize here that this is a national problem that's not just focused in urban areas, and it's also evident and experienced in rural America as well. But how long has have schools been asked to sort of be the safety net that catches kids who are experiencing homelessness and serving their needs?
That's a really great question. Actually, since 1987, a lot of people are surprised to hear that the McKinney-Vento Act included supports for homeless students. So as of 1987, there's federal law that says schools are required to provide access to students experiencing homelessness, which means they can't be denied enrollment, even if they don't have the required paperwork. So maybe their immunization records got lost in the shuffle between home and the shelter, schools still have to allow them to enroll. They also, parents have a choice of whether they want to keep their children in the school where they were originally enrolled before they lost their housing, and that they end up in another district, perhaps in a shelter that's in a different district. The parents get to choose whether they want to keep their kids in the school they were in or move them to another school. And then schools also have to provide transportation. Those are some of the very basic access issues that schools have been required to provide since 1987.
And so then all the additional supports that we've been talking about that Barbara has described to us. In the midst of this pandemic, are schools still legally required to provide those supports to those children?
Yes, they absolutely are. Unfortunately, there's some issues around sort of interpreting what exactly is meant by access, right? So access to some schools just means we know we have to let them enroll. And unfortunately, even that still, even pre-pandemic, that's not a given in a lot of districts. There are still schools and districts that sort of do creative things to prevent homeless students from enrolling. And so sometimes there have to be legal challenges just to get kids to be allowed to enroll in a school. So there's that access piece. And then even once they're allowed to have access to the school building, you know, schools are supposed to provide transportation, but a lot of districts don't know that or don't have the funding because, unfortunately, McKinney-Vento has been poorly funded since the beginning. So even pre-pandemic, it was hard to get those access issues. And now that we're in the pandemic, we're asked to sort of, you know, educators are asked to sort of think about, well, what does access even look like when you're talking about virtual schooling? Is it a device? Is it a device and Wi-Fi? Is it a device with built-in Wi-Fi? Is it Does access have to mean a device plus Wi-Fi plus a quiet place to use it? I mean, the mom we heard from in the beginning of your this segment about standing outside on the corner, you know, so what does access look like exactly? Schools are absolutely legally required to do this, but there are huge questions. And I think even though it's been going on since the spring, there are still a lot of just trying to figure out kind of what exactly are we required to provide and how exactly do we do that?
We're going to hear from a district leader a little later in the show because I also want to acknowledge that it was challenging enough for school districts already prior to the pandemic. There's a lot of hard work being done, a lot of good faith work being done as well. But this has created just that much more uncertainty. Barbara, did you want to just respond to what Professor Tobin was saying?
I would say I totally agree with the challenges that remain in implementing the federal statute that protects the rights of children and youth who are experiencing homelessness. We've certainly seen great strides over the years, but part of the challenge is these children still remain really invisible. Most cities don't have right to shelter like New York City. Many don't have a formal shelter system. So understanding what homelessness looks like is key to making sure that children have their rights upheld.
Right. So to that point, actually, if you both of you could just listen along with me, because we wanted to also explore what does homelessness look like away from cities in more rural parts of the country, like Browning, Montana. Nikki Hannon is the director of parent and community outreach for Browning Public Schools in Montana, which is located on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation.
I always put it in perspective for people. We're 2 hours from any Walmart, and that kind of gives you an idea of how rural, isolated we are.
There is no homeless shelter in the area, Nikki Hannon told us, but there are still about 300 students, 15% of the student population overall, who are considered as experiencing homelessness there. Now, they're either doubled up with other families or bouncing from home to home.
People entering, you know, these housing insecurities, like if they're new to it, you know, they might not even see themselves as homeless. And that's really what we see in, you know, in Browning on the Blackfeet Reservation is I don't even use the word homeless anymore, especially not talking with our families because, you know, they do, because they're doubled up, they have a home to live in. It's just not by definition that secure housing situation we'd like to, you know, see them experiencing.
So Nikki Hannon told us that Browning Public Schools are taking a different approach.
We've renamed the program Espumotziop. Espumotziop is Blackfeet, and it translates to we help each other. So when we're reaching out to a family, you know, we maybe just through the grapevine, through cousins, whoever, we hear they might be experiencing housing insecurity. You know, we introduce ourselves as, you know, we're with the school district, we're part of the Espumotziop program, and we're really just here to help each other.
However, without seeing students in school every day, this overarching problem we've been talking about, Hannon also told us it's hard to know who needs help. And even internet connectivity is hard to come by.
You know, across the country, there's just a lot of trauma. And you compound that with, you know, what we experience on a daily basis on the reservation anyway. Internet just seems to be maybe something that's counterintuitive. It's a priority because it's our only means of communication. But on Maslow's hierarchy, it doesn't necessarily feel, you know, like this important thing because they need food, they need shelter, they, you know, all these other things. But without internet, I mean, we can't even identify that.
That's Nikki Hannon, Director of Parent and Community Outreach for Browning Public Schools, which is located on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in Browning, Montana. So, Professor Tobin, just reflect on what Nikki was saying there, because it's easy to focus on the places that have shelters, but she said they don't even have a shelter anywhere nearby there. So, how much more challenging is the problem in rural communities?
Oh, it's much more challenging. We know a lot less about rural housing instability than we do about urban housing instability, and so identification is a challenge anywhere because both children and parents have an incentive not to identify themselves at the school. Children, because there's a stigma and they don't want to be stigmatized. They don't want anyone to know. And parents, because they also feel a stigma. Unfortunately, they feel embarrassed. They also might not know if they're doubled up that qualifies as homeless under the law for the Department of Education, because it doesn't qualify as homeless under HUD law. So the Department of Housing and Urban Development does not consider a family homeless if they're doubled up with another family. As long as you have a roof over your head, HUD does not consider you to be homeless. But the Department of Education considers students who are doubled up to be homeless, so they get different services in school. But parents might not know that. So identification is tricky anywhere. But like Barbara was saying, at least in urban areas, there's a shelter system, and the shelter can be the point of entry, right? So the school can look at the addresses that parents submit at the beginning of the year where they're living. And if it's the address of the shelter, then they know. And teachers can access that information too. But in places where there isn't a shelter system, and that's a lot of small cities too, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm in Baton Rouge, which is a small city. We have one family shelter. We have one teen shelter, but they're pretty small. Nothing like the New York City family homeless system. So it's really hard for teachers to identify who's experiencing homelessness, because there's an incentive for both kids and parents to hide that status. And so the challenge for schools is really trying to sensitize staff to ask questions in the right way so that parents will feel safe to share that information, or students will feel safe to share that information. And that's, doubly or triply true in rural areas where there isn't a shelter system.
So this seems to be yet another example of how this pandemic is shining a big, bright light on systemic weaknesses, systemic failures in the United States, because you're saying that there are certain situations in which families have an incentive not to identify themselves as experiencing homelessness, and then on top of that, the Federal Department of Education and HUD have two different definitions for homelessness. First of all, I mean, can you explain why the agencies have different definitions? Why there's that divide there?
That is a really good question. I think it's because if we included the number of families that are doubled up, it would make the number of homeless people in the United States much, much larger. So there are, millions of people would qualify, and then we'd have funding issues. And I think HUD is more concerned with, do you have a roof over your head? Why McKinney-Vento is a little bit more forgiving or accepting, I'm not sure. Maybe because we have some sort of tacit understanding that education is a route out of homelessness. And so the more students we can serve when they're young, hopefully it's a preventative measure. But that's a very good question.
Barbara, did you want to comment?
I do want to comment. I would say two things. One, I think there's a perception that if you're staying with somebody else doubled up, you're not as vulnerable. So HUD has really been focused on single adults on the street since, the late 80s. That's who it caters to. So the idea that families would fear shelter, would avoid shelter, there aren't shelter, and stay with somebody else has sort of made them into kind of a second class, if you will. And the idea that they're not as vulnerable, that this is staying, with grandma in a cozy environment, that's not the reality. Of course, the reality is these are very unstable situations, often dangerous. And when we look at the outcomes for children and youth who are doubled up, who don't meet HUD's definition, they're as bad as kids who are staying in shelters, kids who are unsheltered. So there's really kind of no validity to this notion that the non-HUD homeless, if you will, experience of families or youth is lesser, is less damaging. So I think that's a big part of it. And again, schools are unique in that they're in every community. Universal safety net. There's not a shelter or a shelter bed or house for every child who needs it, but there is a seat in the classroom. So that allows schools this wider lens into what homelessness actually looks like and just how mobile and fragile these families and youth are, even if they're not, you know, meeting HUD's definition.
Well, we are talking this hour about students in the United States who are experiencing homelessness in the midst of this pandemic and what they're experiencing now that the school buildings in many of their communities are closed, the places where they were getting the most help, critical services and life-changing support. Those places are closed. So what's happening to these kids? That's what we're exploring this hour with Barbara Duffield and Carrie Tobin. When we come back, we'll hear from someone who works for a school district and the work they're doing there. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be hearing from nurses because we're venturing into month 9 of the COVID-19 pandemic. And if you are a nurse who's been on the front lines in 2020, how are you doing? What are you seeing and experiencing right now? And how is it different from the summer or the spring? What help do you need? Call us with your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Want to hear from the nurses of America for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about students who are experiencing homelessness. In 2018, there were more than 1.5 million American school children who were experiencing homelessness. Now, they're undergoing that experience in the middle of a pandemic, and many of their school buildings have closed. And we're talking about what impact that's having on them with Barbara Duffield and Carrie Tobin. And Barbara and Carrie, at the beginning of the show, we heard a little bit from Jennifer, the mom who's living in Brooklyn with her family, including her fourth grader, Corday, and they're living in a family shelter right now. And the story that she shared with us at the top about them having to sometimes stand outside to use New York City's free Wi-Fi because they had unstable Wi-Fi in their room in the family shelter, so they had to go outside, stand, and do school. Well, fortunately, Jennifer was able to save up and buy a hotspot, so now she has more reliable internet inside her room. And she described Corday's classroom setup in their unit in the shelter.
Actually, being that we're in a shelter, I went and I bought him a project board, and we kind of decorated it, and it says, you know, it has his little Marvel characters on it, and then there's also educational pictures on it or information on it. And we use that as the background so that, you know, he doesn't have to be embarrassed. Like, we're in the shelter and, you know, my friends' rooms are decorated and I have nothing right now. But that's his home classroom.
However, because of the tight living quarters, Corday's school day actually has an impact on the entire family.
We only have one bedroom. And there's four people in that bedroom. So, you know, we have to all wake up extremely early so that he's able to do his schoolwork.
So between internet access, problems with the iPad, co-piloting teaching fractions as well, Jennifer says online school has been quite a lot. but she says they're making it work.
You have to have a lot of patience to deal with this type of situation, and you just have to be, you know, open-minded and a parent, because you wouldn't want your child to fail, so you have to do everything that you have to do to, you know, get the job done.
It's Jennifer. She lives in Brooklyn, New York, currently right now in a family shelter run by Wynn, the largest provider of family shelters in New York City. And by the way, earlier we also heard the CEO of Wynn say that some of the people, some of the families living in their shelters right now, the parents are essential workers as well. So they have to go to work. They don't have a choice. They have to go to work while their kids are trying to navigate online schooling in the shelters. Barbara and Carrie, hang on here for just a second, because we need to hear the voice of someone who works for a school district. So Melissa Douglas joins us now from Kansas City, Missouri. She is Kansas City Public Schools homeless liaison, and about 10% of Kansas City public school students qualify as homeless. Melissa, welcome to you.
Great. Thank you so much.
So tell me a little bit about what it's been like to try and keep track of the kids that you serve and continue offering the services they had or have in school buildings.
Oh, this year has it's been quite the challenge because, as you know, we haven't seen all of our kids or a good number of our families since March. In fact, I usually have a major event right during spring break so that we can kind of reconnect with families, and we didn't get to do that. That was the only opportunity that we usually had that will allow us to kind of update addresses and, you know, and just really check on families, especially during that long period of time of spring break that will allow us to, that the student would be away from school. So now we are struggling. We are trying to use every phone number that we had on file for a family that was previously identified as experiencing homelessness in our district. And, you know, we've gone out, we've just been, you know, visiting with teachers. And again, just really just trying to partner up with a lot of our community agencies, our day stop places, our shelters, so that remind them that, hey, we're still here and we're still trying to find you and reconnect because, like most school districts in the country, we haven't connected with all of our kids that we usually have this time last year. And so we're looking for kids and we're trying to be truly innovative in that regard. So one of the things that I was able to do with some funding that came available is that I'm able to provide prepaid cell phones to some of the families that we were able to get in contact with, especially our shelters families, because we know that it already comes equipped with Wi-Fi and is prepaid for 1 year or 2 years, just depending on the qualification of the system. But most part, I mean, again, we're doing the exact same thing every other rural or major city is doing. And we're just really trying to make sure that we locate our kids and wrap our arms around them because we know that school is the safe place.
School is the safe place. Okay, so right now, are you still all remote?
We are probably 90% remote. The 10% is our district has set up some learning centers that allowed students to come so that they can get some additional support through one of our, you know, like the Boys and Girls Club. But the challenge behind that is transportation because our district is geographically wide. Transportation has always been our number one issue to try to get students back and forth to school and to activities. And then we actually brought in our self-contained high minutes special education students. They come into the building 4 days a week in order to make sure that we are providing them with their educational services that they are mandated to have.
Okay, so I apologize because our connection to you is a little unstable too. I think instability is the theme of this hour today. So, but I just want to repeat something you just said. So right now you're able to bring some of the highest need students who get special education services into the buildings. Is that right? Is that what you said, Melissa?
Correct.
Okay.
And it's not all of our buildings. It's just a select number of buildings.
Okay. So would you like to then be able to bring in more of the students who are experiencing homelessness, whether or not they need special education services, back into the buildings?
Absolutely. That's our conversation when our families, when we are able to reconnect with them. We actually encourage them. We know that face-to-face education is the best thing for especially if they are living in a shelter, because they're there all day long. They need somewhere else to go so that they can continue to fight for their education as well as change their future through education.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about funding here in just a second, but really critical question for you, Melissa, because this has been an issue in districts across the country. First of all, is there a willingness, for example, amongst your educators to have more kids come back into buildings? Because I know that that's kind of it's a challenging topic to navigate.
Oh, my gosh. My superintendent has the heart of gold, and Dr. Bedell wants kids to be in school. But he also understands that we are navigating a pandemic where in education, some of your most vulnerable are our teachers because they are older and they do have underlying conditions. So to balance the need of making sure that we're providing education for our students as well as protecting our staff, it's a very delicate seesaw that he is really on at this particular point in time. Our teachers want to be there. Our custodial staff, our secretaries, our cafeteria workers, our bus drivers, they all want to be available to the student at the capacity that they were pre-pandemic. But we also know that health and safety is a major concern. So that's why they're kind of trickling students in versus saying, hey, you know what, if you're in the kindergarten through third grade, you all come to school. Because what we found in our neighboring school districts, when they've made edicts like that, then, you know, 2 weeks later, the building has to close.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, stand by here for just a second. Barbara Duffield, let me turn back to you. I'm just going to make the presumption, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to make the presumption that this is one case in which more dollars actually would significantly help. And we just heard Melissa say that she like used some resources just to get cell phones into the hands of her family so she can keep track of them. And we did have the CARES Act pass. I mean, was there money specifically earmarked in the CARES Act to support districts in their efforts to not just keep track but continue to provide services for families experiencing homelessness?
Unfortunately, no. The CARES Act was a real departure. Every previous national disaster we've had, whether it was Hurricane Katrina, the hurricanes of 2017, the floods of 2008, Congress has earmarked dollars through the federal program for the education of homeless students to make sure that they do get what they need in times of upheaval. With the CARES Act, schools were allowed, it's an allowable use of funds to support students experiencing homelessness, but it's not required. And so what we've found, based on our national survey of school district homeless liaisons, is that only 18% of those liaisons said that their districts were directing federal CARES Act dollars to students experiencing homelessness. So there's a great need, but there's many needs, and there are many more vocal, visible constituencies. And in all of that, homeless students have gotten lost.
So just to be clear on something, so they're not... The CARES Act doesn't require those dollars to be directed towards those students, so the schools are directing them elsewhere because there's myriad needs?
There's myriad needs, and so there will be, you know, broad purchasing of PPE or broad purchasing of devices or hotspots, but that doesn't guarantee that it gets to students experiencing homelessness. If we're not doing outreach and identifying them and connecting them and meeting some of their unique needs, I mean, some of these students may not have anywhere to plug in a device. Let alone have enough minutes on whatever phone they might have. So the broad general uses don't necessarily get to these students, particularly if it's not going out through that infrastructure, which really is the McKinney-Vento liaisons in the federal program for homeless students.
Carrie Tobin, did you want to jump in here?
No, I think Barbara covered it.
Okay, so let me ask this then, Professor Tobin. Were there still unfinished business on Capitol Hill, right? I mean, what would you ask Congress to do? Is there a role for additional funding or rules to help direct funds where they need to go?
I think it's both. Certainly, we need more funding, but I do think there is a disconnect between the classroom and sort of so we have to think of teachers as the initial contact, because if a teacher can't identify that a student might be experiencing homelessness, then there's no way for anybody at the school administration level or the district, it never gets to a liaison if teachers don't know what to look for. So part of what we need is just training for teachers, which unfortunately really doesn't happen as often as we wish it would. So we have, in many cases, wonderful state liaisons, wonderful district liaisons doing really hard work, but what they're doing doesn't always trickle down to the classroom in the way that they think it does or the way that we think it should. And we need more funding for all of that, because if we're going to have more professional development for teachers, we have to, you know, compensate them for their time or, you know, figure out a way to get them that professional development so that they know exactly what the situation is that they're trying to help solve. And then we just, yes, need more funding in general. Like everyone has highlighted, transportation is a huge, huge issue and has been since the beginning.
I mean, it's to me also the clear message. One of the clear messages from this hour is that the invisibility challenge, right? And that you can't even know what problem you have to help solve if you can't see it, because these families have the pandemic has pushed them off the radar. Now, Melissa Douglas in Kansas City, let me just turn back to you here for a second. So, what help do you need? And say you got it. What would you do? What would you like to do to help transform the situation there right now in Kansas City?
Well, right now, first and foremost, I just want to make sure that everyone knows that homelessness is more than just a school problem. I mean, I love Dr. Tobin's book on Homelessness Comes to School, but it's definitely a policy problem because, for instance, we don't have enough shelter beds in order to support the total number of homeless families that we had before COVID hit. We have one youth shelter, and they've ultimately partnered with one of our other adult shelters and kind of carved out some additional space. And I can say that our shelters are becoming quite creative in the regards of trying to make sure that they are helping families. But if there's additional funding that comes along, I need some more shelters in order to be able to house our families. I mean, right now we are seeing more and more tent cities come up. We are seeing more and more families or individuals that are living up under the bridge and just having a safe place to go while we, you know, conquer this housing eviction situation. And I think that right there, you know, that we can still have more affordable housing. We have lots of blighted properties and vacant lots. But at the same time, we have no one that's saying, hey, we're going to provide affordable housing or mixed housing units so that we can have, you know, multi-income individuals living in the same space. So we're building great new hotels in the city, but we're not building affordable housing that's going to take care of our most vulnerable. And so therefore, we need to start with, for every hotel we build, we need to build a shelter of that same magnitude.
You're reminding us that schools are the hearts of their communities, but the health and well-being of the community that surrounds the school is really the issue, Melissa, right? Because you can't expect the school to be the safety net to catch everybody.
Right.
Well, you know what? On that point, we're gonna wrap up today, because I think, once again, the idea that we have to look across communities and figure out how to support everyone, the health and well-being of an entire community, and how schools highlight where those needs are, is a great place for us to end this hour. So Melissa Douglas, Kansas City Public Schools Homeless Liaison, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Carrie Tobin, professor at Louisiana State University School of Education and co-author of Homelessness Comes to School. Professor Tobin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Barbara Duffield, Executive Director of Schoolhouse Connection, a nonprofit focused on homeless youth and education. Barbara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.